Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jennifer Egan, whose latest novel is A Visit from the Goon Squad. Earlier novels, The Keep, Look at Me, The Invisible Circus, and a collection of short stories, Emerald City and Other Stories. The Goon Squad is a mosaic of a book, which means the structure is both complex and in a way simple. Where did you start in terms of creating a book with an unusual structure?
I started really with the first chapter, which is probably one reason it is the first chapter. I began with something very concrete, and this, I actually don't usually write this way, but I was in a bathroom in a hotel, a ladies' room, and I saw a wallet sitting there in a bag in plain sight. And I thought, I've been robbed many times in my life. I seem to be an easy target. And I thought, oh, gosh, someone could easily take that. And the woman's not even near it. She's in the bathroom stall. And then I thought, well, I'm the only person here. That led to one of those fictional leaps of thinking, so who would take it and why? The next day I thought, I'm just going to write from that question. I'm going to write from the point of view of the woman who takes the wallet and try to understand why she does it. And at that point, I really was just planning to write a story. I was waiting to begin a project that I'd been researching for a long time. I was kind of procrastinating. So I started writing the story about the woman, Sasha, who takes the wallet, who's on a date with a guy she met on the internet, and all these things happen. And in the course of writing that piece, I mentioned her boss. She entertains her date by regaling him with tales of her former boss, who's a record producer, and I found myself writing that he sprinkled gold flakes in his coffee and sprayed pesticide in his armpits. And I just meant it as a kind of eccentric, you know, decadent portrait of a thumbnail sketch of a record producer. But later I found myself thinking, so who is this guy and why does he do that stuff? So I started another chapter from his point of view, which is the second chapter. And in that chapter, which takes place earlier in time, Sasha, the wallet thief, is still his secretary. So we see her in a much more peripheral role, although it is kind of an exploration of the odd intimacy of their relationship of working together for so many years. That was basically how it started. I was not thinking, oh, this is going to be a book. It just felt like I was doing something that felt fun, honestly. I was just letting my attention wander where it would. As I wrote the chapter about Benny, the record producer, in that chapter he's in the throes of a divorce and trying to connect with his son, and he's driving around Westchester and has the thought that he couldn't believe he could ever have thought he would live in this place as he had with his ex-wife. But she, meanwhile, was now the number one doubles team at the country club. So that conjures another sort of cliche in a way. But then later I found myself thinking, but she's got to be more interesting than that. You know, what was it like when they were married and why did they split up? And then I found myself writing a chapter from her point of view.
And that's A to B,
yeah.
Which comes about halfway through the book, then.
Yeah, that one ended up appearing later. So basically, I just felt like my attention would be drawn to one direction or another, and I would find myself falling into writing pieces. The three rules I really had were, as I began to sense that there was a pattern here and I was going to stick with it, one, each chapter had to be about a different person. Each one had to have a different subject. It was fine for people to reappear, but they could only be the subject once. Number two, I wanted each one technically to be totally different from all the others. I really did not want to repeat myself in any way, even in terms of feeling or mood or place. Something had to be very different to distinguish each from the others. And finally, I wanted each to stand completely alone and work with some power without having to lean on anything around it. So those were my three ground rules.
Why the second ground rule? I mean, I understand the first ground rule because as I'm reading it, that's why I was seeing the mosaic and that's why I mentioned the mosaic. But why the decision to have each chapter be different style, different point of view, different way the point of view is presented, different voice? I mean, even beyond the different voice of the characters.
I think it was just a way of trying to push the organizing principle of diversity to its absolute limit. In other words, it's not a book with a central character. I didn't think of it as a novel. I didn't really think of it as anything, just sort of a book. I guess I felt that if I'm not going to write this conventional novel with a forward thrust and a clear line of action and a clear set of characters about whom it clearly is, then I want to go the absolute opposite direction and have it be as diverse as it can possibly be in its parts while still adding up to one thing. And sometimes I would think about those grid drawings that we used to do as kids where they show you a larger drawing and they put a grid on it and each kid or a couple of kids gets a tiny section of the big drawing on their little grid and they have to recreate it. I imagine doing that, but having each section be completely different and yet all fitting together into one thing. It seemed more challenging. It seemed more interesting and strange to have the parts be unlike each other and yet still combine.
As I was reading the book in the early sections, I kept thinking, wow, I know, I can ask her about untangling the web and see if there's actually a straight through timeline. And then by the end of the book, I realized, no, I can't really do that.
You've given up on that.
Well, it becomes less important as the book goes on.
It's interesting. I think I had the same impulse you did as I was writing it, which was I wanted there to be a clear chronological organizing principle. And so my initial thought was, because as I just described, the first three chapters I wrote went backward in time. I started in the present and then I moved backward by leaps. And I thought, okay, that's great. I can deal with that. It's not new. Charles Baxter did it really beautifully in First Light. But I'll do it now. But then that became complicated when I began to want to move into the future, because I wanted to revisit people who had been young in the present, or at that point was about 2006, and I wanted to visit them, you know, pushing 40. Well, the only way to do that was to either move the whole thing into the past, which I didn't want to do, or leap into the future, which I thought sounded really fun. But then I didn't want those chapters to come first, which I would have had to do if I were going to stick to my grand design of backwards chronology. So then I thought, backwards, and then I'll leap into the future. But when I read the book that way, it was actually quite flat, and there was really no kind of chemistry of combination among the parts. It just felt like, blah, here they are. So I had to basically give up on that, too. I had to let go of chronology as an organizing principle completely, and what I ended up using instead was the question of which peripheral character is intriguing enough in the chapter we've just read that the reader will be surprised and hopefully delighted to find that that person is the subject of the next chapter and their inner life is totally available in this intimate way. That was the principle I used.
According to your website, the long chapter, Safari, was written many, many years before, or quite a bit before, as was the chapter taking place in Naples. Is that correct?
The Safari chapter, I had taken a crack at writing a story about people on safari many years before, but actually none of that remains except a sort of ghostly echo of one of the characters who's this actor. Basically, no. The only real overlap between those two was the title. Actually, I may have not even called it Safari, now that I think of it. The Naples chapter, yes. I had written that, much as it is now, some years before. And one thing that was really interesting, it's about a man who goes to try to find his niece who has run away from home and is living in the kind of demi-monde of Naples. What was amazing to me is that I had not realized, even as I wrote that first chapter of Goon Squad about the wallet thief, and I wrote that her father had disappeared when she was six, various things about her background, which were in fact quite similar to the background of the young girl in this Naples story that I had written. But the amazing parallel that escaped me is that the Naples girl also steals a wallet. So it seemed very clear to me in the moment of convergence, which happened to take place in the shower, when I suddenly thought, oh my God, these are the same person, that I had written them almost identically, but I didn't make the connection. It's amazing what we can not see.
That particular chapter, you did a lot of touring around Europe on your own. Does that come from any part of that come from your own experiences?
I guess a little bit. I mean, I certainly, you know, I never got myself into the kind of trouble that Sasha gets into, but I did do a lot of backpacking as a younger person. And I remember actually in the Far East, like in Hong Kong, feeling that there was a way in which certain backpackers who had been going for a really, really long time had very much lost track of what it was they were trying to do. They were sort of inert in their motion. And I remember that there were even a couple of women who were kind of turning tricks to sort of stay afloat in Hong Kong. And I remember being struck by that, by this sort of odd traveling malaise that seemed to overtake certain people, and it became clear that in some cases they couldn't or didn't want to go home. It was a strange and sad scene. So I guess I had been interested in revisiting that in some sense. However, when I went to Naples, I went as an adult with my husband. You know, we ate a lot of pizza and was pretty much problem-free. In fact, I didn't get robbed there, which is a feat for me, although we came very close. We were walking down a street, and an old woman waved us away and said, ladrones, and I thought, oh, my God, I got to get away from here because I had my wallet snatched by motorcyclists, people running, you name it. But no, we had a problem-free and lovely trip. But I found the place so seedy and evocative, the combination of the aristocratic past that's still so present in Europe everywhere, all the old coats of arms and everything, and then this really restless, huge quantity of youth, unemployed, a lot of drug addicts. It was this odd mix of people and an odd feeling, and I thought, I might try to write about this at some point.
Jennifer Egan, in reading about the book, I found all of these metaphors and all of these allusions and all of these themes to the book. And as we're talking, it seemed like the book came about organically. And a lot of that is material kind of figured out when you looked at it afterward rather than during it. Is that correct?
To some degree, that's always how I work because I write by hand and I write in a pretty unconscious way when I'm generating material. I don't really think much. I try not to think. You know, my method is really a dialectic between that kind of unconscious outpouring and a very systematic and analytical look at what I've got and what it needs to be or seems like it wants to be and then how to make it that way. And then having made those plans, which often amount to pages and pages and pages of outlines, I then go back into the more unconscious mode and try to execute those plans. So to some degree, it's always true that I'm figuring it out later, sort of figuring out what I've got. In this case, it was probably more extreme because I was working on it in these discrete units and I was trying to make each one solid, or at least be sure that it was solid, because that was important to me in the whole idea of putting it together. I think that the larger picture of it all was even less clear to me than usual. It took a long time to have a draft of all these pieces that I could read through and really think about it as one thing.
Among the allusions you make is the Sopranos. The idea, I guess, with the Sopranos is that, well, why don't you tell me?
I really loved the show, The Sopranos. I watch very little TV, but that one really caught me up. I watched it devotedly for years. And I found myself wondering why it seemed to have dug into me in the way it did, why I found myself thinking about it in a way that I really never do about TV, although it's true that I don't watch much. And I know there are a lot of recent programs that are supposed to be fantastic, and I can't comment on them because I haven't watched them. But that one really got me. And there were a couple of things that I really liked about it. One was just the polyphonic nature of it. It's all different stories combined over years, really. And then as a corollary of that, I loved the way peripheral characters would suddenly become central, and the way that there was this chasm between public and private. The show traded in plenty of cliches. I mean, Tony Soprano was a cliched mobster. However, his private life was startling and very nuanced, and I felt like the show derived a lot of its power from the surprise of the revelation of his private life, and also the revelations of the private lives of other characters who would be peripheral for a long time but then suddenly break open to us. And I really liked the idea of doing that. I thought, that's interesting. I want to do that in fiction.
It also seemed to me, in watching The Sopranos when it was first on, was that The Sopranos was one of the first shows to recognize the relationship of modern music, or actually music over several years, to each individual episode. And if you listen to the end, you always got a new twist by virtue of what song they played. And I think that relates directly to your book, A Visit from the Goon Squad.
That is a really interesting observation, because even as I am now absolutely realizing that you're right, I didn't think about that. And of course, it was much discussed with the final episode, which I thought was fantastic. Yes, you're quite right. I feel in a way with this book like every road kept leading me to the music industry, but you've just found one more road, which was The Sopranos. I mean, Proust is just full of music and very focused on the relationship between music and memory, but I hadn't thought about it with The Sopranos. I mean, there was no escaping the music industry on this one.
You're listening to an interview with Jennifer Egan, whose novel is titled A Visit from the Goon Squad. Can you please elucidate the meaning of the title?
I'll try. You know, the truth is I just liked the title.
Okay.
I wanted to write a book with that title 10 years ago. I remember thinking when 9/11 happened, Will I still be able to use that title? I don't know. Will all goon squads be that goon squad? So that's a measure of how long I've been thinking of it. I think I mentioned before I'd been stalling about starting this book that required a lot of research that takes place in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, in and around the Brooklyn Navy Yard during and after World War II. And I'm really interested in the women who helped build the ships, et cetera. But I somehow felt that that wasn't a visit from the goon squad. But when I began almost inadvertently, you know, bumbling my way through this idiosyncratic book, I thought, ah, yes, this is the goon squad. And then I thought, of course, so who is the goon squad? In a way, the book is full of goons. I mean, you know, it begins with a woman stealing another woman's wallet, and, you know, people push and shove against each other in all kinds of ways. But there was a moment when I was writing it, and I was writing about this overweight, you know, has-been rock star who has conceived of a grand idea of how to revive his career, which will involve essentially touring till he dies and trying to raise a lot of interest around the question of when that will happen. And he says to the people he's talking to, time's a goon. That's the expression, right? And as soon as I wrote that, I thought, ah, yes, there we go. I've earned my title, I hope. I did kind of wonder whether it should just be the goon squad or something like that. But I don't know. It had a nice sound to me.
There's that long chapter, Ask Me If I Care, about going to the Mabui Gardens off Broadway in San Francisco during the height of the punk era. And I guess you went.
I did. I graduated from Lowell High School in 1980, so I had nothing better to do.
Are you aware that Maximum Rock and Roll, which was the primary radio start of punk, began at KPFA?
I think I kind of did know that, actually.
Oh.
I mean, I totally associate you guys with that. I feel like this was the station I listened to all the time when I was in high school. I was not a punk rocker, and I looked like an ordinary high school student, but I think I and lots of my friends sensed that something pretty original was happening there, and it was really exciting. And I had one friend who became very serious about it and kind of went deep into the scene, and it was tough. You know, she had a drug problem and all kinds of other things. I was not like that, but I was eager to see what was going on, and I logged in many, many late nights at the MAP.
It also got me thinking that there's very, very little fiction written about the punk era.
You know, I was thinking about that, too, as I looked around. There is very little. I don't really know why that is. I mean, if you compare it to, well, but, you know, honestly, I feel like the great 60s novel that would capture the music and the feeling of that time was never exactly written either.
Well, I think the book was written. It was called The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Exactly. But what about the fiction? I mean, the two people should have done it. Ken Kesey was absolutely the man. And I don't know why, you know, it's a big mystery exactly what happened to his gift. Because, you know, he wrote some truly astonishing novels and very experimental and interesting. I also think Robert Stone, who ended up turning to nonfiction to address that era, would have been a fantastic person to do it. So why is it moments of convergence of music and counterculture seem to be difficult to address in fiction? And so, yes, I think there has not been much about the 70s punk moment. And the interesting thing is a lot of people reached out to me when that story was excerpted in The New Yorker to say, I was there. It's great to read this. People had comments. People had corrections. I had a couple of little facts wrong. That was immediately pinned down. There was still a lot of interest in that moment, I think.
The book is divided into A and B, which seems to be A and B sides of a record, an LP. How conscious was that?
It was fairly conscious. I mean, I think it was part of the process of understanding what the structure was. I knew there were two parts of it. And I knew that, of course, it was about the music industry to a large degree. And then I had this idea about these pieces working together through contrast and, in a way, through discord as much as anything to add up to something larger. I can't remember exactly what the moment was when I thought, ah, yes, it's a record album. But it seemed, when I knew it, as if I always had known it. It was a pleasure to in a way, create a bit of an homage to that form because, of course, that's what I grew up with and loved. I feel a lot of wistfulness about the disappearance of the concept album, if you will, but a CD can be the same thing, basically about the atomized buying of music. I can't help but feel nostalgic. It's not just about the technology, and of course, one sounds extremely middle-aged saying, you know, gosh, it was better in my day when we had albums. But it's more that when I see this atomized mode of music buying, I see a difficulty on the part of the artist to convey large concept and also to make listeners listeners listen to sometimes those little songs, those songs that weren't as catchy but really fit into a larger whole and were important. It's going to be very hard to get people to listen to that now.
Looking at a visit from the Goon Squad, in essence, you know, you could have done the same thing. Each of these pieces fits as a short story or within the larger context. So if it were YouTube videos, it could be divided up as well.
True, but I would absolutely hate that because I already know, having read it in, with my, you know, misguided chronological ideas, that it actually doesn't read in a very interesting way. I think, let's put it this way, I think the order that the pieces are in really works in a way that the book does not if you mix them up and scramble them or just pick out some. I mean, of course, I can't force them to read them in the order that I want, but I do have to force them to buy the whole thing. I can do that.
In some respects, A Visit from the Goon Squad is the first iPad book. And the reason I say that is because there's a 30-page section, which is a PowerPoint story. It's a story told in PowerPoint. I'm not familiar with PowerPoint. I've managed to spare myself that agony pretty much. I mean, I've seen a couple of them, PowerPoint presentations, but usually I kind of, my eyes glaze. So when I saw that, I'm going, what the hell is she doing here? But later on realized it is a PowerPoint presentation, but of course a PowerPoint presentation is not on paper. Today I went to jenniferegan.com, and I noticed you had created the PowerPoint, including music.
You're quite right. PowerPoint is really meant to be looked at on a screen, although I have to just say the irony about the iPad is that iPad doesn't have a deal with Random House. You actually can't buy my book for an iPad, so forget about that. I became fascinated by PowerPoint. I, too, was not a PowerPoint user. I mean, I just said I write by hand, so clearly I'm not exactly an early adopter. But I became really interested in it when I was reading about the 2008 election and about the Obama campaign's turnaround. And again, a particular PowerPoint was referenced as the important document that revived the campaign and changed its outlook about how it should be functioning. For some reason, that was the moment that I thought, wow, this genre has become really universal, and I wonder if I could write fiction in it. But I had that thought as someone who had never used it and actually didn't even have enough memory on my computer to hold it. It became a real obsession. I think I was obsessed with it without really knowing why. I think I thought that I wanted to do it because it was an extreme genre, and I was just trying to hit as many extremes as I could. I tried writing a chapter of this in epic poetry. I mean, that's how far I was willing to go.
You went far enough to write one in the second person.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, if you think that was risky, you should have seen this epic poetry attempt. Anyway, so I think that's what I thought was interesting about PowerPoint. But once I finally purchased the memory, purchased the program, was able to read some PowerPoints, and then finally began actually writing my own, I realized that I think what really interested me about it was that it's built around gaps. And the book is so much built around gaps. There's so much action that happens offstage, and I'm more interested in leaping in and out of people's lives over time in particular moments. PowerPoint is basically built around leaping into particular moments without a lot of connective tissue. And, of course, it's not intended for fiction writing. It's about, you know, showing parts of a corporate presentation. But for me, it became really interesting, especially because it allowed me to represent absence in a really vivid way. And that chapter is called Great Rock and Roll Pauses. And it's narrated by a 12-year-old whose brother has a kind of Asperger's obsession with the pauses in rock and roll songs. And it causes a lot of family tension because he keeps playing the songs that have the pauses in them. And then what really drives his father crazy is that he loops the pauses and makes the family sit and listen to just the pauses. So this, of course, makes his father want to jump out a window. I found a way to represent these pauses visually that I thought was kind of exciting. There were a few things that I could do in PowerPoint that were actually very hard to do in conventional fiction. Another one is put text on a page, if you will, and allow for multiple readings. It's not really clear what order you should read certain things in. So I think that was really why I was so interested in it.
And in a sense, coming out of the book afterward, as you explain it, that chapter goes from being almost like a side trip to being the central chapter of the book.
It's a chapter where the book's methodology, I think, lays itself open in a really clear way. I think it's a chapter some people focus on just because it's so strange. And as you say, you really don't expect to have to turn a book on its side and look at a PowerPoint. For me, one thing that was really fun, and this was leading me very far afield from the usual activities that I engage in as a fiction writer, but I loved creating the color version of that PowerPoint. I made it in black and white because I figured this was not the moment in publishing industry history to request a four-color 76-page last-minute insert into my book, but basically creating these different hues and trying to use them to suggest times of day. And there's a scene that takes place as sunset is falling, and this is all happening in the desert. It was really satisfying to create the color version. And then another part that was great, that was also obviously not possible in conventional fiction, was to have a soundtrack. The drama is built around the family's attempts to deal with and absorb this music and its pauses. And in the PowerPoint, you can listen to 10 seconds of music with each pause in the middle. That was satisfying, and it was fun.
At one point, you mentioned a book by a drummer by a band called Semisonic. How did that fit in?
That actually was pretty instrumental. This is quite a good book. It's called So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, and it's by a guy named Jacob Schlichter, who was the drummer for Semisonic. They have one huge hit of many years ago called Closing Time, and I promise you would recognize it. And he just writes this very unassuming, honest, forthright account of what it was like to briefly become a star, like a huge star with a gigantic hit, what that striving felt like, what succeeding felt like, and then what it felt like not to be able to match that again. In his description of the mixing of that hit song, Closing Time, he talks about how they had this particular mixer producer who was known for inserting pauses into songs. And the pauses actually, I can't remember the producer's name, but they call them the such and such pause, and it's his name. That was where I first got the idea of the rock and roll pauses, which I was fascinated by and actually tried to incorporate into my book at other points. I had some chapters that didn't work, and in one of them there was an academic who's writing a book about pauses in rock and roll songs. That didn't work out, but I ended up saving that idea and then fusing it with the PowerPoint.
And the character of Bosco, who was a big star and then falls apart, also has reference to that too. In the sense that that's what this guy is talking about, being a one-hit wonder and being a star.
Right. Well, that's true, yes. I mean, he, at one point he says, you know, I can't figure out how I went from being a star to being, and he describes it in terms that maybe we can't say on the radio, but being a guy that no one cares about. That comes up again and again in the book. People looking back and with that stupefaction that we often feel in noting that time has passed, saying, how did I get here? And that was something that really interested me, the contrast or the paradox of the fact that time is, of course, always passing in this very incremental way, and yet we only can feel its effects in this very quantum way. There's something irreconcilable about our ability to perceive and the way time actually passes. And I feel like that's a rocky relationship that we grapple with all the way through our lives and much more as we get older.
Jennifer Egan, in your website, you list four different stories, one about Bosco, one about a character named Rolf, who's the son of a producer who plays a role early on in the book when he's in his 20s, one called Eyes and Ears, which was an early PowerPoint demonstration that didn't work, and then Sasha, the kleptomaniac at NYU. What happened with those chapters?
The biggest problem with them really was that they just didn't feel fresh. There was just, they didn't have that sense of freshness that I wanted. They felt repetitive. It felt like I was covering old ground. Basically, they just were, for me, dead on arrival. Some of them had moments or parts that were engaging, but it's actually really hard to write a discrete unit that is completely its own, so technically no overlap with this other stuff, and yet to adhere to the characters that we already know and the biographies that we already know, and to have it stand on its own and have power. It was just hard to do that. And I found that as I went, my failure rate became higher, which in a way is no surprise because my choices became fewer. You know, I had these characters. We know quite a bit about their lives. There aren't that many options for me to try to find some angle or some take that could still feel totally fresh and different from everything else was really difficult. I mean, that's why I tried, for example, epic poetry. I forgot to put that in there, actually. I didn't get too far with it because I'm truthfully not a very good poet. So it was clear to me that it was going to have to be doggerel, and I didn't really want to do that.
The last two chapters of the book are science fiction. They take place in the future, and what you try to do, I can see, is do a projection. In other words, they're walking along the California desert, and all of these solar panels turn to capture moonlight, or there's a rock and roll concert at the World Trade Center, now called the Footprint, huge skyscrapers that are empty. The problem with that, because it's all plausible, is that things change in ways we can never expect. I mean, 10 years ago, if I had said to you 10 years ago, we'd be involved in two wars, there would be a recession, and we'd have a black president, what would you have said?
Well, sure. I mean, the nice thing about being a fiction writer is you can do whatever you want, and
sure,
no one can really harm you for being wrong. All you're doing is projecting from the present. You know, I was driven as much as anything else just by the people and wanting to know what their futures were, as I said, and being thrust into the future, because if I wanted to explore their lives at a later point, it was the only arena in which I could do that. I couldn't agree with you more that the future is always full of things that we cannot conceive of. And in a certain way, that's kind of what my whole book is about. The strange twists and turns that are impossible to anticipate. The thing that seems like a sure thing is the thing that doesn't happen, and then the completely unlikely thing does. So I know all that, and I made my projections, and we'll see. Well, I'll talk to you in 2020.
Earlier today, and it'll air at a different time, I interviewed a writer named Alan First, who writes thrillers set just before World War II, and we were talking because one of the important things about his books is that the characters in the books don't know what the future is, but we do. So we have these anticipations. We know that Greece will be invaded by the Nazis. We know what's going to happen, but of course the characters don't. And that becomes problematic in writing a book like this.
It's a fun thing for a narrator to play with. I often think of a novel by Sartre that I read called The Reprieve, which ends with a reprieve in which everyone believes that World War II won't happen. That's where the book ends. And, of course, the power of that is in the knowledge that, in fact, the reprieve did not last. I played with that throughout this whole book. I mean, there are moments where I leap into the future and just, you know, make it clear to the reader all kinds of things that the characters don't know are coming. It was one of the many ways that I enjoyed playing with time. When we're in the future and they're in the past, we're at a huge advantage. There's a kind of understanding between narrator and reader that the characters are unaware of, and that was something that I enjoyed playing with.
I'm also fascinated sometimes with things come up. I'm handed a book, and its subject matter is things that I'm thinking about and everybody I know is thinking about. And what seems to be happening, because I see it everywhere, is people are starting to think about the relation of their past selves when they were younger to who they are today, and those kinds of differences in the way time passes, and I guess how our promise is never fulfilled and yet always fulfilled.
Well, I think so often, you know, what we imagine to be the fulfillment of our promise as a younger person is not probably the same thing that we would call that as an older person. So there's often a disconnect, but in a way, the disconnect is just one of perspective. You know, I look back on myself in my 20s. I almost feel like the books that I read in my 20s, I can't even count as having read. I feel like, I mean, it's not that I was a different person. It was just that there was a lot I didn't understand. I have found that in my 40s, this is something I think about a lot. And I also find that other people I know in that age group are thinking about it a lot. My guess is that it's one of those things that you come to it around this time. And it's funny, you know, I mentioned Proust before. When I tried reading Proust in my 20s, I found the obsessional love stuff to be great. Like, that I could totally relate to. Swan and Odette, absolutely. You know, crazy behavior for love and lust, yes. But time? That seemed like such a dry subject to me. It didn't even seem like a subject. So when the ruminations about time and memory came along, I was bored. It read so differently to me in my 40s. It was so moving and poignant. And in a way, one of the tricks that Proust employs that I don't know if any modern writer dare is that he wrote a book that was so incredibly long that really an enormous amount of time in the reader's life passes while reading the book. So I read it with a group of friends, and I believe 5 children were born among us in the years we spent reading In Search of Lost Time. Now, obviously, we were all doing other things and working, et cetera, but it's one of those things that seems front and center at around age 40.
Jennifer Egan, what happened to the book that you were working on?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's a question to me whether it will remain a virtual book, one of those books that I talked about so much or thought about so much that I didn't leave myself any room to explore, or whether, as I actually think, it's going to be the next thing I do. But the truth is, because I became so interested in these particular women who did this work during the war, and what a strange thing it was for them to be lifted out of these very different kinds of lives they'd had before, thrust into this man's work, and then removed from it the minute the war ended, that I got involved with the present-day management of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which is actually a few blocks from where I live, in an oral history project interviewing ladies who worked there, which was absolutely fascinating. I interviewed a couple in Florida and a number on Long Island and Brooklyn. And in a way, those interviews, I think, had a big impact on Goon Squad, because it was very moving and compelling to talk to so many people at the end of their lives. They may live another 10 or even 20 years, who knows, but for sure the gaze is mostly backwards. That was really interesting to me, and it was interesting just to learn about what they did. The question is, what is actually going to happen in fiction for me with this? And I really don't know. My hope is that when I reimmerse myself in all of that research, my imagination will start reaching out in all kinds of directions. I feel that that will happen, but I don't absolutely know. One of the big questions for me is just how to write a historical novel in a way that's not just the simple artifice of this is taking place in the past. I feel like that doesn't seem interesting to me. I feel like there's got to be something more complicated, or I don't know. I don't know. I'm interested in trying to find a voice that can be more flexible than that and can somehow break through that artifice now and then and do a little more. And I find myself reading a lot of 19th century novels because those narrators are wild.
Have you read French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles?
I have. I should look at that again. That's a good idea, actually. I think that's exactly the issue that he is thinking about in retrospect.
Have you had any interest from Hollywood about The Keep?
Very much so. A script exists. As the producers say, it really captures the feeling of the novel. Translation: they've completely changed the story. It's like when you're looking for an apartment and you see the ad for a cozy apartment and you know that means it's really, really small. Well, then they tell you it's true to the spirit of the book. It means they've changed it a lot. They're nice people. It would be great to make a lot of money. We'll see what happens.
Somehow, I don't see a visit from the Goon Squad working as a movie unless you just took the characters and did something with them.
Yeah, I have no idea. I used to run a film series for independent film directors in New York. It was one of my day jobs. I was so bad at knowing which movies would really make it in the marketplace. Ones that I thought were really dull would do well, and the ones that I thought were fascinating seemed to not even get a distributor. So I've concluded that I have terrible radar for what works in Hollywood, and it's better that I stick with fiction. So who knows? I have no idea. It certainly doesn't have the high concept quality that The Keep had, but even The Keep was clearly very hard to adapt, because when you have to depart so vehemently from the original as they ultimately did, it's a sign that, you know, it was, as they say, not a movie, or it wasn't written as a movie. And of course, I was never thinking about it as a movie.
I think literature itself is such a completely different form that unless you're writing using cinematic techniques, which a lot of thrillers do, but when you move away from that, you're kind of stuck. You're always going to have to eliminate interiority. You just have to.
Exactly. And the question is, you know, I guess the bargain is supposed to work that the filmmaker, in bringing the visual into the conversation, is able to compensate or suggest interiority in a way that compensates for all of that's lost on the page. As we all know, when you love a book and you see it turned into a movie, you almost always feel, with a few exceptions, that was not accomplished. I don't teach all that much, but when I do, I'm always struck by how often movies come up in conversations about literary fiction, and I feel like in a way there's, at least for me, it's really necessary to draw a clear line and say, look, I'm not doing that. This is what I'm doing, and I'm not going to worry about it either.
Have you ever thought about writing a screenplay?
I actually did write one with a partner. It was quite terrible. It didn't work. I don't think I had any real aptitude for it, and what I ended up feeling was, you know, I could spend years trying to get better at this, but I think it's better if I spend those years trying to get better at the thing I actually seem to be able to do reasonably well as opposed to not do at all. So I've ended up just sticking with fiction.
You've been listening to an interview with Jennifer Egan, whose latest novel is A Visit from the Goon Squad. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.